Hello and welcome to the Faculty Forum of the Cornell University Cyber Tower. My name is Glenn Altshuler and I'm the host of a monthly series of conversations with leading faculty at Cornell University. My guest today is Tom Gilovich, a professor in the psychology department and the chair of that department. Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming in today.
Pleasure.
Tom, we want to talk about a book that you have in preparation called Psychology's Most Useful Ideas, but I think it would be useful for us to begin by having you talk a little bit about your background and how you became interested in psychology as an academic field of study.
Okay, well, like many students who arrive at a university, I did not know what I wanted to do. I thought maybe I'd be a lawyer. I liked a lot of television legal dramas, and that seemed appealing. But the more I would take a psychology course, the more I just kept being drawn to it and realized that that's where my mind kept going and thought, this is for me. And I just continued to pursue it.
And so you did you major in psychology as an undergraduate?
Yes.
And then you went on to graduate work where?
At Stanford University.
At Stanford. And then did you come directly to Cornell?
Absolutely.
So you're
25 years ago.
25 years ago, and so your career has been at Cornell.
Yep.
Now, you and I have gotten to know one another some years ago when we taught a course for alumni in Las Vegas on gambling. And I know you've done some work on hot streaks. And before we talk about psychology's most useful ideas, talk a little bit about that project on hot streaks, how you got involved, what you found, what you think was surprising about those findings.
Sure. Amos Tversky, who was a professor at Stanford, and I became interested in this phenomenon that you see in a bunch of different walks of life, where it's like we have a hyperactive pattern detection machinery in the brain that we have evolved to try to spot order and patterns in the world, and perhaps we do so a little bit too much. And there are many manifestations of this. A recent one was when Apple came up with their iPod Shuffle, which randomly played your music for you. As soon as it came out, people were writing in saying, wait a minute, this thing isn't random. It's playing, I just heard Led Zeppelin and now it's Led Zeppelin again. This isn't random. Well, it turns out that randomly determined processes work that way a lot, that when you flip a coin, it's not heads, tails. In the long run, it's 50-50 between heads and tails. But there's a lot of times where you get many, many heads in a row. So we took that idea and applied it to the game of basketball and applied it to this intuition that anyone who's ever watched or played the game of basketball has, and has very powerfully, which is there are some times where this state is visited upon you where the game becomes easy. You make several shots in a row and you become more likely to make subsequent shots. How true is that? Is the basketball lore correct, or is part of it this general tendency to see more order than actually exists? And so we did a ton of statistical analyses and came to the very controversial conclusion that basketball players don't shoot in streaks in any meaningful way. Or let me back off a little bit. In one meaningful way, they do. You can always go back and say, look, Carmelo Anthony was 18 for 22 this game. And if you want to call him hot then, that's fine. But that's not all that people mean by a hot hand. What they mean is Carmelo Anthony is now 9 for 11. He's hot. That's going to predict how well he does in the future. And that, it turns out, just isn't the case. How you've done at one time doesn't predict how you're going to do it another time. And that is something that I've had colleagues say, I lecture about the most controversial things that you can imagine in psychology. When I lecture on this, I get more arguments from students, more resistance than any place else.
And as I remember, you got resistance from some of the great figures in basketball, including a man who just recently died, Red Auerbach.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, the brains behind what is arguably the most successful sports franchise in American sports history, he got wind of the research, I think, from the USA Today, and I think he said something to the effect, "So a guy does a study. I couldn't care less."
So that's sometimes what happens to psychologists,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
They get ignored by icons in basketball. And your study really showed that that if a person makes two baskets or three baskets, that doesn't make it any more likely that he will make the next basket than if he did not make the previous basket, that he'll still, over time, reach his average.
Yeah, the best predictor of the likelihood of making the next shot is who's guarding the player, where on the court the player is shooting, what kind of shot, who is the player. But the player's recent history of success or failure tells you nothing about the probability of making the second shot.
So why do we, you said something about the brain's zeal to generalize, uh-huh, in some sense. Is that what is behind the sort of fervent criticism of your study? Why do people, first of all, have this sort of generalizing tendency, and why are they so firm in the face of contrary evidence in holding on to it?
Right. Well, yeah, let's break those two questions down. The first one, why is it that we can trace it to the tendency to, we're on the alert for things that fit into patterns, because after all, structure in the environment is something that we can use. That's what's responsible for discovery in advance. You've got to find the pattern in the world, the order in the world, rather than chaos. And in order to do that, sometimes we overshoot. And again, you can find this in domain after domain after domain. And so if we show people hits and misses in a game of basketball that are randomly determined, there's no structure to the data at all, people will look at that and say, yeah, that's streak shooting. And the reason they say that is because with a random arrangement of hits and misses, there are a bunch of times where a player makes four or five in a row, and it looks like the player is hot at that time. But it's no different than the kind of clustering you get when flipping coins.
Yeah, and the coin doesn't try to
right,
to end up on heads, but it might end up on heads four times in a row, five times in a row.
Right. So that's the first question. It's due to that tendency of the mind to try adaptively to try to find patterns. And part of the resistance to the message is because what you're telling me, Mr. Psychologist, jars with my everyday experience. It looks like players are shooting in streaks. That's part of it. But also, there are domains in which success does breed success. And this seems like it would be one of them. So in the financial world, that if you succeed initially, you now have more money, which makes it easier to succeed the next time. If you fail initially, now you're under tighter constraints, which is harder to succeed the next time. So there are many walks of life in which success breeds success, and part of the resistance is a carryover from those domains where it does exist to this one where it seems like it should exist.
Yeah. I was reading a book recently about the tendencies of the mind to generalize, and this a person also said that we have in our minds also critics of that generalizing tendency, parts of our mind that are constantly saying, well, we're generalizing, but isn't this a unique case?
Uh-huh.
What's your sense of that and how the mind might navigate between those two tendencies?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one for which there's a great deal of current research interest, and it speaks to the issue of are we really, we say things like, well, I'm of two minds on that, and oftentimes it's pretty close to literally true. That is, much research suggests that there are a set of processes in the brain that are very automatic, uncontrolled. They just happen, analogous to what philosophers have referred to as intuition. And then there are these more controlled, effortful processes that serve as a check on intuition, our rational process, what philosophers refer to as reason. And there are a lot of times where you're pulled in two different directions. And that suggests that, well, there must be two minds doing the pulling.
Okay, let's turn to psychology's most useful ideas. How'd you get interested in a project of this sort? And then maybe give us some examples of some useful ideas.
Well, you know, I don't know the answer how I got used to it, how I got interested in it. Partly it comes from teaching introductory social psychology, which is my subfield of psychology, social psychology. And it is a set of ideas, set of topics that students find particularly interesting because it has relevance to their everyday lives. And so that made me think that what these students are getting by reading this material, everybody should have. These are important kinds of ideas. And the idea is not to have a book necessarily on psychology's best ideas. There are a lot of really good ideas about how language works, for example, how the perceptual system works. And they could be useful to some specialists, but the average person is going to say, oh, that's really interesting, and move on. It's not going to change the way that you speak. It's not going to change the way you perceive the world. But there are some things in social psychology that knowing them changes how you approach your daily life.
Okay, let's talk about some of those ideas.
Okay, well, one of the themes that I talk about in my course is what social psychologists refer to as the doctrine of situationism, which is the idea that to a surprising degree, our behavior is determined by the situations in which we find ourselves. It's as if everyday people in their everyday lives function more as personality psychologists. You behave the way you are because of your genetic makeup, because how you were raised, and so on. I behave differently because of my genetic makeup and who my parents were, and so on. And that's, of course, true to some degree. But much more than people realize, small details of the situations we happen to find ourselves in influence our behavior. And to give you an example, many people who've taken a psychology course have heard of Stanley Milgram's studies of obedience to authority.
Yeah, one of the famous psychology experiments.
It's probably maybe with the exception of Pavlov's conditioning experiment, this is the most famous experiment in all of psychology. And what happens in this experiment is that a subject, let's say me, my job is to teach another subject. In reality, and let's say that's you, you're actually working for Milgram. My job is to teach you how to memorize a list of word pairs. Anytime you get one wrong, my job is to give you feedback by administering a little electric shock. And at first, this is quite uneventful. You miss one, 15 volts of electricity. What's the big deal? But every one you miss means I have to go up one notch on the shock board. Now I'm 30 volts, again, no big deal. 45, no big deal. But it's diabolical. You've been coached to miss a lot, and soon I find myself in this agonizing dilemma of should I administer 150 volts of electricity or not? And the absolutely stunning part of Milgram's experiment is that 65% of the subjects in the experiment go all the way to the end of the shock board, are administering what they believe to be over 400 volts of electricity. Now, of course, you're not receiving
right,
any electric shock.
Right, but the person is writhing in pain.
Absolutely.
As if
he
were receiving that kind of pain. So
right.
From the point of view of the person administering it, clearly it's a real
agonizing dilemma for me, the subject. What do I do? They're asking me to deliver shocks, but I know that's not a good thing to do. And what you find is more people than I think anyone would have expected are willing to deliver what is clearly a potentially lethal dose of electricity. Now, that in and of itself, you could say, is an illustration of this situationist doctrine that, what is it? Who would have thought that individuals will do that? But there's something about the situation sufficiently powerful to jar our intuitions about what people are capable of doing, and over 65% of people deliver that amount of shock. But if we probe a little deeper, we see the situationist idea even more clearly, because Milgram's experiments are often described as blind obedience. People just go along to the commands of an
authority. They were told, keep doing it, and they just keep doing it.
They just keep doing it. Yeah, they're told that, and they just go along. That's actually not quite right. That is, fortunately, Milgram filmed his experiments. And so we see the behavior of his subjects. And no one is blindly doing anything. People are not just mindlessly going along. These are agonized individuals trying to figure out what to do in a very trying situation. And almost all of them exhibiting signs of stress. And almost all of them try to terminate the experiment. They call the experimenter's attention, say, I'm concerned about his health over here. Shouldn't we do something? Many of them get literally out of their chairs and say they're going to stop. But the experimenter then says, the experiment requires that you continue.
Got to keep doing
it. They sit back down. So the experiments, in some ways, are almost misdescribed. They aren't obedience experiments. They aren't demonstrations of blind obedience so much as they are demonstrations of ineffective disobedience. Everybody tries to disobey. They just aren't very good at it because the nature of the situation is such, very subtle features of the situation are such that people who want to disobey can't find it within themselves to disobey. People don't want to make a scene. They don't want to violate some seemingly innocuous social contract between themselves and Milgram and so on. So it's very subtle details of the situation that determine people's behavior. And when you think of it that way, I think it makes this inexplicable thing. 65% of the people are going to administer over 400 volts of electricity. Who would do that? I would never do that. It makes it a little more understandable because most of us can relate to times where we had very good intentions and we just couldn't translate those intentions into what we really thought we wanted to do or should do.
What about the 35%? Is there unwillingness or failure to complete the experiment? Does that say something about these other forces that you talked about earlier, their upbringing, their sets of values,
right,
and so on?
Presumably it does, but we don't know. That is, we don't know systematically what made those people different from the people who obeyed, other than the fact that they disobeyed. Milgram paid attention to that, administered some personality scales that existed at the time, but nothing came out. We couldn't say that people who came from these families were the ones who obeyed, these are the ones who disobeyed. People who have this personality trait tended not to obey. We just don't know. Now, and of course, you can't do those kinds of experiments today. Because it was so agonizing for the subjects in the experiment, psychology sort of policed itself better, and there are now human subjects committees that
wouldn't allow something like that to occur.
Right.
Now, let me just sort of sum up for a moment, if I might, that what you're saying, it seems to me, is that perhaps more than we might wish to acknowledge, the situation is a powerful determinant of human behavior and human action.
Yes.
So why is that useful? What makes that useful for us? So we now know that. How do we now make it useful in our own lives?
Well, it's useful in a number of respects. One of them is that there's a natural human tendency, if you're trying to change someone's behavior, you think someone's behaving inappropriately, not in their own self-interest, you want to get them to act differently, to stop consuming drugs, to get out and vote, whatever it is, there's a natural tendency to try to increase the push on the person to do that, to motivate the person more. And what the situationist doctrine suggests is that often isn't going to work nearly as well as figuring out what's preventing the person from doing that. What are the environmental blocks to that kind of behavior? And if you take those away, you'll get the behavior that you want. Oftentimes, people are perfectly well motivated. People are motivated to save more. People are motivated to vote. They just don't get around to doing it. And this alerts us to pay attention to the details of the situation, the physical situation, and more importantly, the social situation. What are the social norms guiding behavior? And if you pay close attention to those details, you can figure out how to alter them to produce the behavior you want. Now, let me give you an example.
Okay.
Also, Milgram's experiments took place at Yale University. Another experiment in this tradition took place probably 10 years later at the same university, where Yale was trying to, for the health of its student body, trying to get its student body to inoculate themselves against lockjaw to get a tetanus vaccine. So they students, even though they were offering this for free, students weren't taking advantage of it. So they enlisted some psychologist to help them with this effort. And the psychologist decided the best way to do this would be to scare the student body population into getting this. So they showed them all sorts of grisly films of what...
What do you look like when you have lockjaw?
Yes, exactly. And it was successful in the sense that the students were scared. Oh, don't want that. And they all developed the intention to go to the health center and get inoculated. A trivial percent of people actually did that. So the experimenters then went to phase two. And phase two is remarkable for how small of an intervention it was. They showed them the films again. And then after the films, they said, here's a map of the Yale University campus. And on the map, here's where the health center is. Okay. Now, these are students that have been there for a while. They know where the health center is. But they get a map with it circled. And they said, Glenn, can you think about when during the next week would be the most convenient time for you to go and get your inoculation? We don't actually schedule an appointment for you. We just ask for you to mentally rehearse when would be a good time to go. Those two simple things, as trivial of an intervention as you can imagine, increased the participation rate sevenfold.
So if I would say, oh, gee, I think I can go there on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock, that's a time I don't have a class, then I would probably act on that.
Yes.
The next Wednesday.
Yep.
Because I had sort of made that note.
Right. Whereas if you just had the vague intention, boy, I better get an inoculation, that looks really scary. Day one passes, day two passes, and eventually you forget about it.
Now, why is that, Tom? I mean, if you're really scared, does your fright fade? Is that what happens? That I would think, why wouldn't frightening me be imprint itself sufficiently on my consciousness that I then did the simple actions that you ignited by suggesting them right then and there?
Well, the power of that fear is that it creates a very powerful intention. So it's successful in that regard. But then what determines whether you translate that intention into effective action is dictated by a whole bunch of other concerns. It's a generalized intention. I better do that. Well, it needs to be translated into a specific intention to actually be activated. Let me give you another example I think illustrates this tension between good intentions and actual action and how to make the actual action that you want in a population easier. In the United States, if you do public opinion surveys, people say that they're very much in favor of organ donation. Most people think if they die, yeah, if you can use my kidney, if you can use my liver, great, I'd feel good about that. Only somewhere around 10% of people actually become organ donors. If you look at public opinion surveys in many European countries, the favorability rate is exactly the same as it is in the United States, but the percentage of people who are organ donors is over 95%. What's the difference? Why are people saying one thing here and acting differently, saying one thing there and acting in ways that's consistent with what they say? Well, in many European countries, they have what's called an opt-out program. You are an organ donor at birth unless you do something to say, you know what, this violates my principles. I don't want my organs used that way. Whereas in the United States, we have an opt-in program where if you want to be an organ donor, you have to do something kind of difficult. That is, sign some form and have two people witness it. Everybody says they want to do that, but getting around to actually doing it produces a roadblock.
But in certain respects, isn't that example sort of the opposite of situationism? It's not creating a situation in which a person will behave in XYZ way. It's actually preventing. It's actually not using situationism.
Well, it depends on what you mean by using it. That is, certain European countries, and not all of them, there are other European countries that are exactly like the United States. They have opt-in programs, and their participation rate is exactly like ours. So you could say, if you're very much in favor of organ donation, you could call those countries with an opt-out program more enlightened countries. They've structured their situation, they've structured their society that produces much more organ donation than we have. We've produced a situation that blocks that behavior. So in both cases, we're determining behavior, one case favorably and one case not favorably.
Yeah, but it would be, but it's almost, in the example you gave, it's almost like, dealing with taxation by taking the money out for taxes before somebody has a chance to spend it.
Yes, absolutely. And there are many financial implications of situationism as well. So, for example, that is an area I mentioned, briefly alluded to this fact that a lot of people have very good intentions about saving, but just don't get around to it. Well, this suggests that the most effective thing that you could do is something the government decided to do, I forget exactly when, let's say 25 years ago, have 401k plans and so on, where money automatically gets taken out of your paycheck, so you don't miss it. You don't have to do the difficult thing of taking in the money and then writing a check to your savings account. It automatically goes there, and that makes that behavior really quite easy.
Some people, now you can tell me if this is semantics or not. Some people would listen to a couple of the examples that you gave, the organ donation example, let's say, and the taxation example, and to say, well, that's an example not of volition on the part of the person who's participating, but of kind of an element of coercion by government, because they're structuring a reality which is actually removing decision-making capacity or likelihood from the person. Is that valid, you think? I guess what I'm saying, Tom, is I have a sense, I'm supposed to be your average respondent to this, that some people might think of some of the examples you're talking about as somewhat more coercive.
I don't think of it as coercive. That is to say, behavior always takes place in a context. That's inevitable. And you can try to save in a context where there aren't 401k plans, or you can try and save in a context where there are. And nothing takes place in a vacuum. Now, it raises some interesting questions about what's government's role. A lot of people would object to government shouldn't be trying to structure environments to make desired behavior easy. I happen to disagree with that.
Yeah.
But it does raise issues about to what degree can or should a government be paternalistic. And I think social psychology, that's an ongoing policy debate. And I think social psychology has some very powerful ideas to contribute to
that
debate.
Yeah, what you seem to be saying as well is that that social psychologists have discovered a fairly weak link between intention and behavior, that the relationship between intention and behavior seems to be weaker than maybe we'd like it to be, that almost all of your examples document pervasive intentions, which then do not result in the behavior that one might say the intention predicts.
Absolutely, absolutely. Particularly when there are these minor roadblocks in the environment preventing that. And so if you want that behavior, figure out where those roadblocks are and take them away.
So would a sound social policy in a democratic society involve an attempt to understand intention and then try to provide a situational context in which intention is more easily realized in behavior?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Social psychologists refer to this as paying attention to the behavioral channels, that you've got this intention, and to realize it, you've got to go down a behavioral path some way. And sometimes the creek, or whatever metaphor you want to use, is dammed up. Reorient it. somewhere to get the behavior that you want. There's a role for government there, not a dictatorial government,
right.
Not an excessively paternalistic one, but one where the society says, we want organ donation. Why not make organ donation easier?
Yeah, I mean, again, another example that comes to my mind is seatbelts. That the equivalent to what you're saying is that if you got in a car and a seatbelt immediately went on around you and you had to take it off, that would be one kind of situation. Another one is an actual law that says we'll give you a ticket if you don't. Those are two different ways of getting the desired result.
Yeah, and both of those are act on the individual. I'm trying to increase your motivation. Another way to do it, consistent with this idea, is that you make automakers devise a car where the seatbelt automatically goes on, and then you have to disconnect it. That's the channel. The channeling idea. Make that behavior of wearing the seatbelt easy. It just happens unless you decide to opt out, like opting out of the organ donation.
Okay, so we've talked about situationism as one useful idea. How about another?
Well, another one is what social psychologists refer to as construal, and really what they mean by that is the idea that's pervasive in the social sciences that people don't react so much to objective circumstances as their subjective interpretation of those circumstances. That's a truism. And it turns out to be just enormously powerful, sort of like situationism. There's nothing at some level surprising about situations. People go, yeah, of course environments matter. They just matter so much more than you ever imagine. And the same thing is true about construal. If we want to understand everyday social interaction, we need to understand how people are interpreting particular environments. And if we want to understand, in particular, interpersonal conflict, we have to understand the perspectives from which they're coming at that particular conflict.
Okay, an example.
Well, I think it was last week there was a story in the New York Times about certain universities without the prestige, let's say, of Cornell, who faced declining enrollments and in the past had tried a strategy that seems to make tons of sense. There's not enough people are applying. We've got weak demand. So let's lower the price and demand will go up. Didn't work. If anything, it boomeranged and even fewer people applied. So they've decided to mimic places like Cornell and raise their tuition in the face of declining enrollments, and their applications have gone up. Now, why is that? It's the same university as it was before with the same faculty, but that high price tag tells people this is a serious place. Maybe it's worthy of attending. And so you change people's interpretation of it by making it seem a more prestigious, a scarcer kind of commodity. By the objective circumstances, that shouldn't be happening. But by virtue of how people interpret those subjective circumstances, we see the
behavior. So under what kind of circumstances would that work? Obviously, you know, people making toothpaste just can't triple the cost of the toothpaste. So there needs to be some set of additional factors which would help you decide whether or not what the construing that's going on might involve.
Yeah, and many people in the field of marketing take this idea and try to apply it there. And to a surprising degree, you can take things like toothpaste. If it becomes, wow, this is a hot item, this is scarce. If you're able to, by changing the price, get people to think, this is going fast, people want this, I better act now, you can create that. So it's involves some of the details of what the nature of the commodity is. Now, the academic one is, since a lot of, in the minds of many applicants, is how will this be perceived when I get out? That matters as much as the experience that I had when I was there. It's ripe for these kinds of construal effects because they're now trying to anticipate how other people will view their undergraduate degree.
So does the construing have something to do then with the importance of the commodity or product? What if it's something that we just might be interested in as opposed to something that might have an important impact on our lives?
Well, the more subjective the more open to alternative interpretations the issue or the product may be, the more powerful this idea is going to be. There are some elements are more objective than others. What's the color of this background? We're going to agree on that much more. Is it, would you rather have white bread or brown bread for breakfast, as your toast for breakfast this morning? That's much more subjective, and there's going to be more latitude for this idea there. But again, the message is more than you think. Even for these seemingly objective circumstances and issues, there's a lot of room for alternative interpretation.
And so what you'd have to do is measure in some way how your product or is being construed?
Absolutely. You need to pay attention to that. So, we can say, and this can be true, we've gone into this country as liberators. We know that to be true. That's our reality. So it makes sense that we would expect to be greeted as liberators. Well, in fact, given the nature of what tanks look like, what people with weaponry look like, and what people who don't speak the local language look and act like, it's probably not terribly surprising that we weren't greeted as liberators. And we didn't pay sufficient attention to how is this going to be seen by them, because we saw it through our own eyes.
I don't know what you're referring to, but I'm assuming that that some people listening might. So let's talk a little bit more about some political manifestations of construing. Give me a couple of examples again about this in the political world.
Okay. Well, in the last in any campaign, you can craft a message in a couple of different ways. You can talk about what you stand to gain if the Republicans get in office, or if the Democrats get in office. Or you can take that same thing and turn it around and say, what do we stand to lose if we aren't in office? And it turns out that human psychology is such that we're much more responsive to potential losses than potential gains. Psychologists refer to this as loss aversion. So if we flipped a coin, for example, betting $100, and if it comes up heads, I give you $100. If it comes up tails, you give me $100. The person who loses the $100 feels worse than the person who wins feels good. Now, gaining $100, just that's a nice thing, but it's not nearly as powerful as losing $100. We are loss averse.
Is that principally then why so-called negative campaigning works better? In other words, again, I'm thinking about campaigns that I've followed in my own work, and Democrats saying, just as an example, look, if they win, you're going to lose your Social Security,
yes,
benefits, and senior citizens apparently moved by that argument more than, well, look, if we win, we'll get you a little bit more help with prescription drugs.
Right.
That's it.
Negative information, because it's more powerful, tends to stick more than positive information. The negative dominates the positive. And there are many ways of demonstrating. This is pervasive in political campaigns and everywhere else in life. Suppose you had a big plate of delicious pasta. You couldn't wait to eat it. And a small cockroach walks across it. It's wrecked. It's completely contaminated. One little bad thing wrecks this giant plate of good things. Now notice that the opposite can't happen. You can't have a plate of cockroaches, and there's nothing, no little thing you can add to it that suddenly makes you say, wow, this will be great. So the negative dominates the positive. And again, it's all over the place psychologically.
This reminds me of a phenomenon that was used by advertisers in the 1920s and 30s called scare copy, where, again, advertisers invented things like halitosis, bromidosis, and would say, look, you're not going to get that first date, you're not going to get a job, if you don't take Listerine, for example, whose sales were hyped based on these, I won't say invented illnesses, but certainly the kind of phenomenon that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes sense that we would be that way, that it's just, if you think of our ancestors in a hostile natural environment, you need to be aware of the threats in the environment. Not recognizing that that's a snake in the grass and not recognizing that quickly is possibly the end. We don't have to be as sensitive to potential gain. Sure, it's a good thing to find meals and prey, but if you don't get it now, it's not necessarily a death sentence. You can get it tomorrow.
But we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask you about some work that you've done that may or may not be related to this, and that is your work on happiness as a phenomenon. Is happiness then what? Is happiness achieved if we have fewer of these negative feelings? So where does happiness relate to some of the kinds of things that you've been talking
about? Well, that's a great question, but we need another 40 minutes to handle happiness. Happiness is a complicated subject because it's not just the absence of these negatives. As early as the Greeks and possibly earlier recognized that a lot of happiness comes from overcoming these negative things, that we're happiest when we're striving, when we're motivated toward goals, which are overcoming negatives or at least potential negatives. So it's not the complete absence of those kinds of negative things. It's striving to eliminate them, to put them aside as a big part of happiness. And happiness is a field that we do talk about in the introductory social psychology course, and it's a huge area of research right now. For a long time, psychologists didn't think that you could study it because they didn't know how to measure it. And now they trust the verbal measures. When you say you're happy, it turns out you're not always right. But your judgments of how happy you are correlate, for example, with behavioral measures of how often you smile. It correlates with what your friends say about you. And so psychologists trust that more. Plus, there are other mechanisms for studying it. You can put electrodes on your skull, and it turns out that people with lots of electrical activity in the left cerebral cortex tend to be happier than those who have lots on the right. So if you ever have the misfortune of suffering a stroke, you'd rather have it on your right side than on your left side to be happier afterwards.
So does that mean, Tom, how much then are you mentioned that your subfield is social psychology, and you're drawing then on studies by fellow psychologists who are neurobiologists, who are, just talk about that for a minute or two, how a social psychologist draws on research information from other subfields or other fields.
Yeah, well, it's an exciting time to be a psychologist because there's a lot of really interesting work in lots of different areas of psychology. It's a very interdisciplinary field of study. And so what people find out when they look at people's ongoing social behavior, when they ask people questions, when people fill out surveys, at some level it's always been known that that has to correlate with what's going on in the brain, and now there are techniques available that allow people to actually do that mapping. What's going on where in the brain, and what does that tell us about the behavior that we see? So it's a very interdisciplinary enterprise. And Cornell, with its graduate committee system, makes those kinds of interdisciplinary efforts much easier than other places, I think. And it's one of the many wonderful parts about doing psychology here.
Okay, so I want to thank you for sharing some of this work with you. I'm not certain that you've made our viewers happier, but I know you've made them better informed, and maybe we'll have you come back and talk about happiness at another time.
I'd be happy to.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.